This is a Crowd podcast.
Welcome to the Fertility Podcast, where we aim to educate and empower you on your fertility journey, whatever stage you're at. I'm Natalie Silverman, a broadcaster and fertility coach, and I had my son after successful fertility treatment.
And I'm Kate Davis, an independent fertility nurse consultant. We'll be your trusted guides, chatting each week with experts and people just like you to let you know you're not alone.
Let's dive in. So here we are, another episode of the Fertility Podcast. You're about to hear almost a comedic chat with our guests. We had a bit of a mission before we managed to record. Just to set the scene, we're still recording remotely and we were quite ambitious in the chat today. There was four of us and the technology that we use is pretty cool, isn't it? Now that we can all see each other.
Yes.
Because Kate and I can see each other's faces and we can see our guests, but there's always something. There's always a bit of a snag with a mic connecting or an echo. And so you can almost hear it in our voices at the start of this chat.
Relief, I think, that we've actually managed to get together, the four of us.
Yeah. But before we talk about the episode, have you had a nice week? You've been travelling, haven't you?
I have. For the first time, now that we're allowed, I have been back home to the Cotswolds, which has been lovely, just for 3 days.
Isn't it nice going inside?
Yeah, going inside, staying overnight and being able to hug, you know, all really good things.
So
I've been doing that. What about you?
Well, I had my jab, my first jab, which I had an appointment, so I thought I'd just rock up, but there was a very lengthy queue and I didn't have a coat. You might have seen on my stories at the start of last week. Got very wet and, but it was fine. Felt a bit, you know, a bit tired after, but I'm very pleased and feel very relieved and just delighted that I'm a part of the vaccination program. I know it's something that I've been watching with awe, you know, your work vaccinating people. And it was just brilliant to have had it done. And
did you feel quite emotional? Because a lot of people have said to me they feel quite emotional when they got there.
I was too wet and cold, to be honest. I was relieved because I had my new white trainers on and I was like, why did I put these? I was more concerned. And she said to me, it was funny, she said to me, how are you with needles? And, you know, when you've been through fertility treatment, I hated needles before I had my treatment. And having been through treatment, my response is very different to how it was before going through fertility treatment. I was like, fine. Whereas before, I was always, and I still am funny when I have to give blood.
But nobody likes giving blood.
Yeah, but yeah, I was like, yeah, I'm fine. And it's over so quickly and, you know, you don't feel anything. And yeah, I'm relieved and just pleased. And because I have been putting things off until I've been, you know, vaccinated. And the hugging thing now, I know you have to still wait a couple of weeks, but yeah, just feeling like things are getting back to normal is great. Obviously, we all still need to be sensible, don't we?
We do. And I have to admit, I mean, I'm fully vaccinated, both vaccine doses now, because I've been obviously on the front line giving the vaccines. And the feeling, I'll never forget the feeling of, even with my first one, particularly my second one, the relief of knowing that I'm fully protected was massive. And it's such an overwhelming feeling.
I did on the way home think, wow, it's hugely significant in our life, what's happened, the fact that we've been through what we've been through. And then, yeah, I was dwelling on it a bit. I wasn't saying I was getting emotional physically, but it was very significant. And I look forward to the day when you have that feeling too, because it will come. It will come. And you had your first
I had the pleasure of vaccinating my first pregnant lady. And obviously she came with an awful lot of questions. I think she'd been, her GP had kind of encouraged her to come. But I think once she got there, she's just the enormity of it and her anxieties. But she was 13 weeks pregnant, so in her second trimester. Now, the kind of the guidelines are that you can, when you're pregnant, you can have the vaccine at any point. Some women may choose to wait to the second trimester, so that's from 12 weeks onwards. She did choose, she decided to, she was 13 weeks. We had a long conversation about the fact that you get your vaccine in now and then you're protected for when you're most vulnerable in the third trimester. And I think she felt really reassured that, you know, she knew then she was doing the right thing for her and her baby by getting protected at that point. So, yeah, it was a good one. It was an interesting one. And that's my first of what I have no doubt now we're in that age group will be many, many women.
Well, any questions, of course, you can ask Kate if you've got any questions about the vaccination. We have talked about it on our socials and on the podcast before. But today we are talking about solo motherhood. Oh, my goodness. Welcome to another episode of the Fertility Podcast, where we have just had such tech gremlins that I'm going to zoom into this latest conversation, because we are talking today about solo motherhood with two ladies who have been on the podcast before who are solo mothers. And I'm going to link to their previous chats, but I wanted to catch up with them again to kind of get their pearls of wisdom. So we're going to welcome Jen Roberts and Mel Johnson. Now, Jen is a journalist and the author of the book Going Solo. She's got two children, Astrid and Zavi. And Mel is a coach who supports women considering solo motherhood. She's got an amazing community called The Stork and I, and her daughter is Daisy. Hello, ladies.
Hi there. Hi.
Now, Kate and I have, I think we've both spoken to Jen, but only I've spoken to Mel in podcast format. I know you know each other. But Jen, when we last spoke to you, you were in Barbados with your two children. I mean, that was a pretty ambitious trip, wasn't it?
I know. Looking back on it, on reflection, it really, really was. I'm never really someone who likes to turn down an opportunity, and it was a job. And it was before the pandemic. It was maybe 3 or 4 months before the pandemic. So in one way, I'm absolutely, you know, so grateful that I had to the chance to go somewhere quite far afield, because I can't imagine that happening anytime soon. And yeah, on the other, I'm like, that was actually completely, it didn't feel nice because I was having to actually rely on the kindness of strangers.
Did you get a break at all?
I'm trying to think. A little bit, yes, because They had launched a single parent package, which was why they wanted me to go and review it. And so there were little bits of childcare added in.
But Mel, you're an avid traveller, and I know you've made a point of travel, obviously not during the pandemic, but you've made a point of travel still being and continuing to be a prominent part of your life with Daisy, haven't you?
So yes, I travelled loads before the pandemic. I've been to Bali, Budapest, Greece, all over, and some extensive travel in the UK. Obviously, that's been harder during the pandemic. But one of the reasons that I felt it was really important for me to do that is because that was my life before children, and I didn't want that to significantly change. And also, being a solo parent, I wanted to continue to see my friends. So most of that travel was to with people or to see people. For me, I don't feel like a holiday is necessarily just going with my daughter, although as she gets older, that's a bit different. But when she was young, a holiday is going with a group of people and having that additional support and, you know, having other adult company with me.
Would you consider traveling? I mean, if it wasn't for that, would you, like Jen? I just think Jen, you're incredibly brave to do that, to go as far as Barbados with two children. Mel, would you consider doing that? Because I don't think I could do it. I genuinely don't think I could do it.
I don't think I would, but I don't think it's because I'm not brave enough. Because when I went to Bali, I went on my own. So I travelled on my own, and, you know, the airport and all of that stuff. It's more for
but
me
with
about
a child, I think.
Yeah, it was, and that was with Daisy.
Yeah, Daisy went.
Right, okay.
She was in my carrier, so she was like a baby at that point, which actually is slightly easier than a toddler, probably.
Yeah, definitely.
But so it's not about not be wanting to travel with a child. It's about whether it's really a holiday when you get there. So for me, a holiday is I have to have other adult company. You know, otherwise, I don't know what I would have done. I think I would have felt a bit lonely otherwise. So, yeah, for me, I just enjoy going more in a group or to see people. Yeah.
Well, we'll talk more about the support part of all of this, because I want to start just talking about your decision to do it. Because Mel, you posted recently on your Instagram about how you agonized over the decision, whether it was right for you and whether it was fair on your child, and how it took you 3 years to make the decision. And I want to just talk about that decision process with both of you. Mel, do you want to tell me a bit first, just kind of a quick overview of that decision process?
Yeah, so I think, you know, the decision process at the time and hindsight are different.
Yeah.
So at the time, it was letting go of the fairy tale. I wanted the fairy tale. I wanted to be in a rom-com. I wanted the happily ever after that everyone, you know, that's portrayed in the films. And I struggled to let go of that. There was a bit of my ego at play. I didn't want to be a person who hadn't succeeded, in inverted commas, at a relationship. Honestly, it was less the practical side of things, to be honest. It was more the fairy tale side and how I had imagined doing it. that was what I had to let go of. And in the end, I have to be honest, it was time. So I just thought, if I don't do this, I might miss out altogether. And that was just not an option for me. The hindsight part of things has worked through all of those things and realised it was the fairy tale that I was looking for. And now I'm firmly on, this is my situation. How do I make sure that my situation is the best it can be, which I work at every day?
It's rewriting that narrative, isn't it? Rewriting your own story. And that's, I can completely get that. That's the difficult part.
It is. But once you learn how to rewrite it, it can be amazing. So my thing is having loads of people around me. I've always wanted loads of people and I've sort of created that. So I've bought a house in the middle of where all my family live. Yesterday, I was just looking at it unfold in front of me. There was like people in my garden, people coming in and out of the house, people popping in. And I was like, this is what I wanted. And the fact that one of them isn't a partner makes a head and a tail of difference to me. Brilliant. There's loads exactly. of people that I love coming in and out, and that's what I created for myself.
And Jen, what about your decision process to, you know, to go down the solo motherhood route? Did you spend a good couple of years thinking it through and working it all out?
It's so funny, isn't it? That whole, as Mel was saying, that looking back on it to where you are now, where it's your life. So you don't think of it day to day because you're just a family.
You're in it.
Everyone's a family. Yeah. I don't think it was as long as that. I think I always really thought I would have children. I had my fertility checked and I'd really believed it was going to be sky high because actually I'd had a miscarriage maybe a year and a half previously and hadn't intended to get pregnant. I didn't know whether I could carry a child, but I didn't think actually getting pregnant was going to be something. So I more did that just to reassure myself, or so I thought at the time. Although I had spoken to a friend about becoming a solo parent before I even had my fertility check. So I think I had to do some of the background research to even get my fertility tested. Because if I had decided at that point not to act on the results, there's not really much point in finding out those results in the first place. I was really devastated by the results. And I remember because I was going to a hen do that weekend, and in that way that you kind of continue your plans and it takes a little bit of time for your brain to catch up and go, hold on, no, like I've just had some life-changing information. I need to sit and cry for a little bit about this. I was pregnant within about 6 months of that. So 6 to 9 months of that. So it was actually quite a quick process. Looking back on it, I wonder how much almost thinking I'd been doing, but without really admitting it to myself. And Mel, what you're saying about that fairy tale, I think it's a big thing to interrupt your own expected narrative, I guess, and change your story. But yeah, similarly, I think you have to make sure you're doing it in like that positive way of doing it is such a good thing. And I think the minute I got those fertility results, that was it. I just kept thinking this, it could be the thing in life that I really regret when I'm old. And that was just, that just happened to be for me. Like I know lots of people would respond so differently and it's funny, isn't it? But that just, it felt important to me. And so then the decision became quite simple, in fact.
So the next big decision after that, after you decided you're going to go ahead with the treatment for both of you, is choosing your donor. Mel, how easy was it choosing a donor? What was that process like?
For me, it was relatively easy. I used a clinic in the UK that has a sperm bank attached to it. And one of the things with that is you get much less of a choice. Now, for some people, they freak out and they're like, there's not enough. Like, I need more choice, because I think as human beings, we like choice. But actually, what it meant was that it made the decision making process easier. So they asked me to complete a questionnaire, which was predominantly physical characteristics. And then they provided me two options that met that criteria that I'd submitted. And then there was two letters one to myself and one to my child. And I chose the one that I liked the sound of the best. So very different, okay. Because I know a lot of the people I coach have like spreadsheets of 50 different ones with all different, and they can hear voice notes and, you know, so wow, much more yeah. information. But personally for me, it made it easier.
Jen, for you, was the process similar?
It wasn't that far different, probably because I'm not very comfortable with Excel, so I've never spreadsheeted anything.
Don't do spreadsheets. Limited choice in my
life. Yeah. There was more choice. I mean, there was a big gallery of profiles. I decided that health was going to be my real overriding thing, so I had a criteria. I found it very difficult with the last few. I was living with flatmates at the time, and my Italian flatmate found the whole thing so fascinating, and she was a great help, because in Italy you wouldn't be able to choose a donor in this way as a single woman. She enjoyed reading through as well. It was interesting. I think I gave it lots of thought, but I felt like health was a sensible thing to go for. The website I used, and this is a different experience, I think, is a little, it feels a little bit like a dating website. And that is quite a weird thing, because then you're starting to look at it and be like, hold on, you know, you're looking for someone to pass on some of their genetics to your child rather than to be a dad day to day to that person. And those are different things, right?
Did you ask anybody else, Mel, or did you keep the decision to yourself?
I, from the two, I did speak to family members. I spoke to my mum, I spoke to my brother, and they just said, yeah, I'd already really chosen, so I don't know why I really asked them. But just for confirmation, I suppose, and they said they agreed. I think one of the things that Jen says that I totally agree with, I tell this to people all the time, as someone who has serially internet dated, I am an absolute romantic and an optimist. Every time I like started speaking to a new person, internet dating, I'd be like, this guy seems perfect. He's, you know, I've got really high hopes about this guy. And then you meet them and you're like, oh, okay, that's not what I expected. I think we have to bear in mind that choosing a sperm donor is the same. You're not going to meet them to fully understand, you know, who they are and what they're about. So you have to just go with the information you've got.
And the decision that you made, Jen, to have two children, and the decision that you've made, Mel, to have one child, is that something that you did from the start? Did that change once you'd had your first child?
Oh, it's an interesting question. I guess now I've got my two, I kind of feel like Zavi was always there in the wings. Really, I guess with anything fertility related, you don't get to decide though, do you? So I was incredibly fortunate that I was able to have both of them. My brother is a couple of years younger than me, and we're very close. And my parents divorced when I was a teenager, and like just the friendship and support that we got together. I wonder whether there's something in me that, having had that model of family with a strong sibling relationship, it felt quite natural to, it made me very open to the idea of siblings for my children. I think it's just such a personal choice, isn't it? Well, if you get the choice.
Yeah, I think especially as someone who has one child as well and has made the decision to not have more children, and I'm talking about me here, and as a sibling, it's a huge choice that you've actually made. And for all the different considerations that I made, and I've talked about it on the podcast before, it is a big responsibility. And I'm interested, Mel, in your thought process around it as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's really tricky. If we go back to the fairy tale, you know, that includes two children for me. If we look at the fairy tale versus the practicalities, it's a challenge, because I would love to have another child or to at least try. And I can't come to terms with the fact that that's not going to happen. So I have got an embryo left, which is probably going to stay there forever, because I can't say to myself, definitely not. But realistically, I think I would make my life really difficult. And Yeah, it's a really difficult decision because I don't want to get caught back in the same loop I was in before that thinks if I was in a relationship, then maybe I would do this. But the reality is probably if I was in a relationship, I would have tried for a second, but I'm not. So it's a really tough one. But personally for me, as things stand at the moment, I've decided that I don't think I could manage without making my life really difficult.
It is a really interesting balance, I find. Like, Savvy's just turned 2 and things are noticeably so much easier all of a sudden. And it makes me realise that actually just there are times where, for example, I'm trying to deliberately give each of my children more one-on-one time, but partly because of the pandemic, where I know everyone had the most, you know, solo mums tend to have brilliant support networks because we've cottoned onto that pretty early on, and tend to be quite sociable people. But a pandemic sort of stops that. So Astrid and Savvy didn't get that much one-on-one time. And I do remember at one point sitting there and thinking, I've gone ahead and I've become a solo mum, and I really believe that it wouldn't have been helpful for my children for me to have a relationship with someone who I wasn't in love with, and that isn't a good model for them to see. But I was thinking, my, at the time, 3-year-old and 1-year-old, they wouldn't care about my feelings towards a partner. They just want time and attention with adults, and they just want as much love as possible. And so there are downsides, and I don't think I'd have ever noticed that if it hadn't been a pandemic. There definitely are so many things to balance up when you're outnumbered in that way. And when I think about, I mean, Astrid was so young when I had Savvy. She was a baby. And, you know, even now I'm just coming out and trying to sort things. And Mel, I follow you on Instagram. I look at all your tap to tidies and I'm like, oh my gosh, you're parenting with a really, really tidy home. I'm now cleaning out like baby toys because I haven't done that, because in the last 2 years, that was something, you know, I have a cleaner in when I'm working. So it's not like we've been living in a way that isn't, but those things like the sorting, that hasn't happened for 2 years to me, and I'm only just getting my head above water. So it is, there are things that I have just dropped, you know, things like that from my life, and things like, yeah, that. So it is that, you know, you're just one person, aren't you? And you can give as much time to as much as you can, but I don't think anyone can do everything.
Well, we'll link to your book, Jen, and Mel has a brilliant podcast with all sorts of important conversations about the different stages, and Mel does her coaching, because what I want to, I suppose, get from this as a insight into what this experience is like is the kind of the pearls of wisdom that you'd give to anybody who's at the start of this journey, considering it, knowing what you know now, knowing the decisions that you've made and the things that you've put in place. We've talked about the importance of the support network. What would you say, both of you, Mel, if you want to start? And I know that you are very open on your Instagram about the ups and the downs, which is brilliant, because I know, you know, we talk about it a lot, that you want to be very authentic, that it's not all rosy. And I love that Jen mentioned the tidy, because I mean, I know Mel personally, and she's a very productive person. And I know that is a thing that you like to do, but it's not always that straightforward, is it? It's not always easy.
Yeah. So my advice would be, choose what's important to you. So, you know, if you've got children, like for me, my mental health, living in tidiness, I'm just weird. It's like really important to me.
I'm the same.
It's like tidy house, tidy mind type thing. I need it. Mm-hmm. But that's important to me. Other things I also leave. You know, you can't do everything, I think, as Jen says. So pick your battles, almost like I don't give Daisy a bath every night. I'm not up for that battle. So some people, that's really important. So it's like, choose what's important. I think from the minute you start considering solo motherhood, start saving. If it's even an inkling of an idea that you might do this in the future, just start saving, because it's really expensive for it to go through the treatment, and then you're the only provider. So you know, get your finances in order. And then I think the thing for me is, a lot of solo mums are strong, independent women who are not used to asking for help. So personal advice to me is you need to start exploring being a little bit more vulnerable and inviting more people in to help you. And that's something that's really difficult. I was in IKEA car park the other day and a guy said to me, "Do you need a hand with that?" And I was like, "No." I can handle this extremely heavy wardrobe on my own. And then literally I had to sort of like skulk around to his car and say, "Excuse me, can I have some help, please?" Because my initial thought is, "No, I'm fine, I don't need help." And it's about learning to invite people in to help you.
That's good advice. What about you, Jen?
Yeah, those are brilliant bits of advice, actually. Having confidence in your own instincts is really important. I think you learn that quite quickly as a solo parent. And it might be something that you actually learn on the job. And I think that's fine as well. But I think you kind of do have to, like when Mel was saying she checked something, you checked it, you checked the donor with other people, but really you decided it yourself. And I think you do come to a point where you almost do. It's lovely to ask the support of other people, but I think you do become more attuned to what you really believe in. And I think that's happened for me over a process of a few years. And I think perhaps naturally before having children at times I could be a bit of a people pleaser, and you become a bit more focused, really. And actually being focused, I suppose, would be a bit of a tip. And I think it sort of plays into, just echoes what Mel was saying about, you know, work out your priorities. That is so important for you and for your children. Yeah, just having that conviction to choose what works for you.
And I'm also curious, because you've both put your experiences out there, you know, you've both decided to speak about your experiences. And I'm interested in the kind of comments that you might have had from people who are looking to do this. Is there a common fear? I know we've mentioned cost, and obviously we haven't talked so much about the story you tell people. And I'm going to leave that for people to hear your thoughts on it by looking and reading the stuff that you both share. But is there, before we let you go, is there a common concern? I don't know whether you could say just one.
For me, because I coach women, I've coached like more than 200 women on this now. And so there's definite themes. One is that you'll never meet anybody, so you're signing up to being single forever. One is the impact on the child. One is the ability to manage solo. It's like the practical things, the financial things, and then the, you know, loneliness and the impact to you personally, and, you know, whether you'll be able to sort of almost like emotionally manage. For me, that's kind of like some of the themes that I hear. But the biggest thing by far is letting go of the fairy tale. I think everyone who comes on the coaching, that's the bit where they're like, "But I just wanted to do this, you know, with the love of my life."
A lot of the people who get in touch with me, I guess, haven't met a support group like yours yet, Mel. So I'd say that I probably get an email, say, every week from someone who's read my book and is saying they're in a similar situation. So it's caused them to think, and that went up during the pandemic, which I thought was quite interesting, like during the lockdowns. But a lot of them are wondering about support. But I wonder whether then people are a bit further down the line when they're talking to you and they've got the support, you know, and have spoken to other solo parents, which I think is a really important thing to do, isn't it? To get a really, like, get a realistic idea of what's
one of the things that I've always kind of been really, I guess, anxious about. And now I've got two children and I haven't obviously been a solo mum, but my husband used to go away with work for 6 months at a time. So he would go and we wouldn't see him for 6 months. And my biggest fear during that time was getting ill myself, because then I thought, well, who's going to look after children? Is that a common fear among women?
Do you know, one of the funny things is I read Genevieve's book and said to her, one of the big fears is dying. And I thought I was like really weird thinking that. And then I read Genevieve's book and I was like, oh, this makes me feel so much better. Everyone's got this fear. Like, so many people have said that they've got that fear.
I mean, that is my absolute biggest fear. And even a kind of like, oh my gosh, the idea of dying before they're grown up. And it must be for every parent, but I wonder how much the idea of knowing that your children would be orphans and that you've so deliberately brought them into a world where they don't have a broader branches of their upper tree. Yeah. So that's, yeah, if I could guarantee that would be basically, I just don't think I'd really, I mean, often if I look at what any fear is, if I drill it down, that's the root of it. Because actually the illness, you know what, even in a pandemic, now my mum's been vaccinated, I mean, she wouldn't have been up for it before, but I think my brother, you know, like, I think if I became really ill, I don't doubt for one second that my children would be looked after by someone else. I'm really lucky. I do have a really good support network, and I did have someone, in fact my neighbor opposite, when I said to her at the beginning, and I was crying one day, I was just like, I don't have a plan B anymore, because I like to always know that there's lots of support as backup if I need it. I find that really reassuring. And yeah, and she was like, I'll be your plan B. So actually the practicalities, I think people help and they like to help. And when my children are grown up, I'm going to spend a lot of time paying back into the
overstretched
mother fund. Yeah, yes, picking people, shopping up. Like, oh, you look like you're not quite managing. Can I at least help you across the road with that child that's running off? Yeah.
We love the karma. Well, I think your insight is so valuable for people considering this. And like I say, we will link to all the resources because we do just want to signpost and knowing, you know, where you're both at and having gone through a pandemic. I mean, I bet when you were considering solo motherhood, you could never in your wildest dreams have imagined the pandemic in the mix. The fact that you've survived a pandemic without going totally insane. Mel's even stopped drinking rather than increased drinking, which work. I think is testament to,
oh my goodness, Mel.
To what your resilience can be. But thank you, ladies, for chatting and sharing your thoughts. Is there anything, any last final Jerry Springer thought you might want to share?
Just from me, some of the things you said, Natalie, about help. I've produced some like small booklets about, you know, getting a support network, telling your friends and family, building your mum tribe. So yeah, if anyone is stuck on any of those, like,
bits, we'll put a link.
Yeah.
That'd be brilliant. Thank you. All right, ladies. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So as I said quite a few times during that chat, we will put, as always, links to lots of the resources from both Jen and Mel. Obviously, they're both talking about their experience having done it. And if you're listening to this and you're thinking about it, then they are both brilliant people to reach out to. We can't really bring you better examples of women who are flying the flag for solo motherhood, can we?
No, I mean, absolutely. They have, well, you could say they've been successful, haven't they, at solo motherhood? And I guess both of them probably say, oh, you know, we have days that aren't always successful, but then that's parenting anyway, isn't it? We all have days that aren't successful with parenting. But I have to admit, I mean, I do feel in awe of them, because having experienced a minutia, as I said earlier, with my husband being away for 6 months at a time, of what they go through, I am so in awe that they can do that full time. And I know they've got great support networks around them. And actually, sadly, I didn't have massive support networks around me when my husband was away, because we were so far away from family. So maybe that's my fear, perhaps. And I think maybe with a support network around you, it would make it so much easier. And that's the important key thing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Right now, we are going to check in with Dr. James Nicopoulos for Ask the Expert. Ask the expert.
Ask the expert.
Ask the expert.
Ask the expert.
Ask the expert. I have lean PCOS. The lean bit is self-identified. Really high AMH, 79. I have just had my round of IVF cancelled as I didn't respond to stimulation. Lots of follicles, but too small. I understand from the clinic they were expecting the opposite. I'm really struggling to find any information on poor response to IVF in PCOS and wondered if there were any websites, books or information you could point me to. I'm looking to understand why and if there is anything I can do differently to help.
I think a couple of things immediately spring to mind. Well, the first thing to say is I don't think this lady probably has an intrinsic problem. I think it was her first cycle. And the two things that come to mind is, number one, probably the clinic were very understandably cautious about her starting dose because her AMH was so good and were concerned about hyperstimulation risk. And it may be that they have a policy, if there's no response, to cancel after a set number of days. So clearly just starting at a higher dose and then titrating down if they need to, knowing that you've got the agonist trigger there as a backup to minimize hyperstimulation. Number two, it's what gonadotropin they were using. Again, as a lot of people know, these injectables are either FSH only or FSH and LH, which helps mature eggs. Naturally, isn't necessarily needed for IVF. But there's a subgroup of women who have got very often those people who have a low BMI, who don't produce enough of their own LH, who don't respond to Gonal-F or Fosterone or the FSH-only injectables. So if this lady might be PCO, but with element of not quite producing the right hormones as well for other reasons, stress, low BMI, over-exercising, it may be that if she used Gonal-F, switching to something with LH like Menopure may make her respond better. So those are key things for her to consider.
Ask the expert.
Ask the expert.
Ask the expert.
Ask the expert.
Ask the expert. Make sure you let us know if you have a question that you want answering. You can either put it in the closed Facebook group, which is thefertilitypodcast.com, or you can DM either one of us on our socials. I'm at FertilityPoddy.
And I'm at Your Fertility Journey.
And the other thing you can do, and we love how popular the Brew at Two is becoming, is join us every Thursday on the Fertility Poddy Instagram. Kate and I have a chat at 2 o'clock. It's about a 20-minute chat. We get a brew, we invite you to do the same, and we tell you what's been going on with us. But more importantly, we answer your questions. And there's a lovely community of people there. So yes, do come and join us there too. And you can always submit your questions beforehand. If you see any of the posts that we both share on our socials, you can pop your questions there or below. Or if you're happier emailing, just email info@thefertilitypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed this episode, please, please just take a moment to rate, review, subscribe and share the podcast. We love hearing what you think. We always, always feel very special, like a virtual cuddle, isn't it, when we get a review. Knowing that we've helped you, knowing that we're maybe signposting, helping your sanity, any of those things, helping you feel less alone, is why we do what we do. So please take a moment today to do that. And we say thank you in advance for it. And until the next time.
Crowd Network, a place where you belong.